I'm Dee Mae Roberts. Welcome to Stage and Studio on Arts Watch. As part of Women's History Month, I wanted to take a look at BIPOC women's history with visual arts in Portland. And who better than to talk with about the visual arts landscape, especially since the 1980s, than my next guest. Roberta Wong is a veteran artist whose conceptual art and art installations have been seen throughout Portland and Seattle and elsewhere. As the gallery director of the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center, she highlighted artists' work for 15 years, both emerging and established artists such as Adrian Cruz and Lillian Pitt. She also produced IFCC's annual Kwanzaa exhibit and celebration, and I believe it was one of the first organizations to do so in Portland, but we'll find out. Wong collaborated with Oregon Historical Society's Folklife Program, Oregon Women's Caucus for the Arts, and Vietnamese Artists in America. Most recently, Wong worked with artists in a show curated by Horatio Law called Descendant Threads, and this was at the Portland Chinatown Museum. I've known Roberta Wong through the years and have always admired her work and her support and advocacy for other artists. So it's my pleasure to welcome artist Roberta Wong to Stage and Studio on Arts Watch.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's nice to see you. I'm actually curious about what you have behind you. You've got an altar, it looks like, and it has a Buddha and some family photos.
That is correct. I set that up recently to acknowledge the passing of my brother, Albert Wong, recently. And it's a fond reminder of both his life and the life of my parents who I've also passed. So it gives me pleasure and comfort to have that set up.
Well, it's lovely. And I think it's a beautiful remembrance. So thank you for sharing that with me. You know, it kind of falls in with my question because I've known you for so long, you know, both personally with your artwork and also how you've supported other artists. I was wondering though, what was your first memory that inspired you to create art?
I was, as a child, very engaged in artistic play, I suppose. I used to enjoy making little mud pies. I remember drawing a lot when I was a child, and I drew in a realistic fashion, which was unlike children in that age group. You know, again, when they're learning to make a tree, they have a rectangle and a circle. And I was into the more sinuous lines and movements of life. But I sort of lost interest as I entered the school system and found it unchallenging to make pictorial depictions of stories and life in general. But it wasn't until my senior year in high school, you have those extra credits you can play with. And I took a ceramics class, but all I did was make sculpture busts of, the first bust I made was of an African-American head. And at that time, it was the mid-60s, early 70s. It was the time of school busing. And we had a lot of African-American students bused to our school, which was Cleveland High School in Southeast Portland. And I had several student friends that I enjoyed meeting and interacting with. And I made, I don't know if it was intuitively, but my first bust was a kind of a Black empowerment figure.
I'm very curious, though, what was the response that your parents, your family had? You know, knowing Asian families, they're not always supportive of the arts, right? You know, because you can't make a living at it and all those reasons. You know, it doesn't seem like the most secure kind of profession to go into. Did you feel like you had family support?
I did feel encouraged because they appreciated my talent. But economically, again, I grew up in a family restaurant business. It was a daily part of my life. Even though I pursued art from high school to college and had all the academic lessons laid out for the next 4 years for myself, my family never challenged my desire to pursue the arts. Unfortunately, my father passed away in 75, and at that point I dropped out of school and didn't return to it until the early 80s. But it was at some point where I felt I couldn't leave the family business because if I left, my family would have to work harder and have less family support. So I felt guilty for even wanting to leave. But I had a heartfelt conversation with my dad, and because I wanted at that point to go to Europe and explore that environment, and as most artists do. And my father surprisingly accepted that and encouraged me to do that. But it seemed like once that self-imposed restriction was lifted, that desire was no longer there. I didn't feel the necessity to have to leave home to find myself, so to speak. And I pretty much, you know, feel that allowed me to just focus on my life here in Portland, supporting the family and pursuing my artistic direction.
I want to get into that in a second, but I was curious about the restaurant. What was it here in Portland?
Tuck Lung's restaurant. It was a business my grandfather started in the 1930s.
Roberta, my family used to drive from Eugene, you know, actually Junction City outside of Eugene, to come up for our, you know, every other month trip to Portland to get our supplies of rice and vegetables, and we would have dim sum there. I had no idea. So I might have actually met you, you know?
I grew up in the kitchen. We had a large family, so my older sisters were out on the floor waitressing, and
it just brings up so many memories because I love that. It was like my favorite little, you know, trip to the big city to do, you know, and to get something that was Chinese, you know, was a big deal, you know, because we had nothing. So I just wanted to tell you that. I've known you all these years and I did not know that.
Well, I think growing up in a large family and growing up in a very public space, because I felt like our business was kind of central to the community in that it was a location where people would come and gather and pick up their annual or monthly supplies and a chance to have coffee or tea over, you know, people they don't see very often. And so I recognized that and appreciated that, but my personality was suited to be in the back room. I prefer that. And I think that continued into my public life in that I prefer more supportive role as opposed to being out front and center.
So, Roberta, you were, I'm still thrilled that we're connected through Tuck Lung Restaurant, but you were also talking about how your personality was more to be supportive. So that's why you were working more in the kitchen, because that was your way of supporting. And so you translated that into your artwork and community work as well, because then you started volunteering at different organizations, didn't you?
Yes, after finishing college and an artist typically has to figure out what they're going to do, because unfortunately, during those years, they did not teach you about the business of art. And so you had to figure out how to make that transition from working in a school studio to finding your own space and finding the means to economically support yourself. My first volunteer activity was at the Portland Art Museum Rental Sales Gallery, which exposed me to sort of the economics of sales and also opening my eyes to the number of artists being represented in Portland. And what was interesting to me as one of my final classes in art history, when I returned in the 80s, they had a new offering that wasn't available before, and that was a studies of women art history. And as a consequence of that course, I did a survey of Portland Art Museum collection and noted that the ratio of women artists represented in their collection was 10 to 150. You know, it was a really obscure ratio. And then I also surveyed the commercial galleries open at that time, and the ratio was a little bit better, but not, again, significant. To give you a sense of the landscape of Portland's art community back then, Initially, there was one professional gallery, technically, that represented artists, which was the Fountain Gallery, operated by Arlene Schnitzer. And she was the main patron of artists and provided stipends for them to do their work, but also the potential for economic income. And in those early days, it was one of the few venues available to professional artists. But then that began a new movement by the early 80s when I finished school. There were options that artists created for themselves. And in those days, institutions like the Northwest Artists Workshop, which was a cooperative of artists who created the space and the venue for professional artists to exhibit, artists who didn't meet the museum standards of the time. They created their own options. And the Northwest Artists Workshop was one. Blackfish Gallery came into being at that time as well, which was more professional artists that found an option for themselves. Blue Sky was also a strong, option for photographers presenting photography in a contemporary context.
How many of those galleries did women and BIPOC people in general, or artists in general, how accessible were they?
At this time, multiculturalism was kind of the new infant darling, I guess, of the times. And the venues, those nonprofits, weren't particularly oriented towards the issue of race, but they did show diversity of medium and concepts and just opportunities. That was the birthing of IFCC as well. IFCC came out of the desire to see representation in the art community by people of color. It was located in North Portland in an old firehouse station on Interstate Avenue. Commissioner Charles Jordan was the only African-American commissioner at the time, and it was under his bureau that IFCC found a home. And it wasn't designated in any particular budget with the park. We didn't have to compete with other park programs or other arts programs. We were in and of itself a priority. Because of the direction of Sue Busby, the director at the time, it was more of a multicultural focus.
Well, I want to talk more about the IFCC, but so through your volunteering, it sort of led you into this way of supporting BIPOC artists and women, especially with the rental gallery of the Portland Art Museum and such. So this sort of led you to the IFCC, didn't it? And to become the gallery director there.
I have to acknowledge that the rental sales gallery doesn't get a lot of recognition, I think, in the art community, but it was one of the earliest venues operated by women. They were women who were the wives of or the associations of funders who supported the art museum. And these women were acculturated to the arts. And so they supported and operated this opportunity for our local artists. And I think during Women's History Month, I think they need a shout out as well. And it was all based on volunteer labor and love.
Let's talk about your work as a conceptual artist, because especially your earlier work did center a lot on Asian American identity and representation. And I'm thinking of some of your pieces like, and I have a hard time even saying these titles, All Orientals Look Alike, and the latter piece titled Chinks. I mean, I have a hard time. But there was a very purposeful way of bringing up a dialogue that you felt needed to happen at that time. That was like in the 80s and the 90s, right? So tell us about that.
This is in the mid 80s, 1984, Metropolitan Arts Commission, which was the precursor of RAC, offered a grant to ethnic artists. And this was a time when the folk arts was being promoted. And I responded to a grant offering contesting that ethnic artists did traditional work. So there was an expectation that as an Asian artist, I would be engaged in practicing Asian art, whatever that may entail. With Kanataka Ikeda, Robert Dozono, we submitted a grant. and proposed a group exhibition of Asian American artists in Oregon. We surveyed and came up with 20, 30 artists as a statement that we are a diverse body of people.
Frankly, I hate to interrupt you, but I am just shocked that Asian American art was considered folklife art, you know, or folk art. That's astounding to me. It's almost like the Oscars saying that a film that is like 50% Korean or Chinese, even though it's American made, is considered a foreign film.
Right. But, you know, thankfully they had a woman there who was receptive to the message and was very supportive.
So tell me about the exhibit or the application that you made and the exhibit that you got to do.
Again, this was located in the middle of Chinatown where community members had never stepped into a gallery before. So visual arts in any ethnic community is a blessing, but a challenge to support because it hasn't been a priority, at least an economic priority in those communities. And it's still a challenge to get participation from the different ethnic communities that live here in the United States because of the challenges that they have to deal with in making this social fabric wearable in America. I was hesitant how we would be received within the Chinese community, and in particular my own piece, but it was very well received and people were very appreciative to have that presence of fellow artists. And this was a multi-ethnic exhibit, so Chinese, Japanese, Filipino, or Middle Eastern Asian, artists showing together was a new concept somewhat, the pan-Asian look of our community, because we're often in our own separate silos and we don't often have an opportunity to know that we exist amongst each other. This was 1985, I think, when we had this exhibit, 84, 85. In the beginnings of multiculturalism and the appreciation of different ethnic groups, a short-lived one, I'm unfortunately, but a time of real positive energy and influence, I believe.
What was the work that you did? What was the piece? Was that the All Orientals Look Alike one?
Yes, All Orientals Look Alike was my first installation, and it was presented within the Chinese, it wasn't a social club, but the CCBA was a place that historically supported immigrant Asians coming to America and helping them resettle and understand the social and the legal fabric of American life. And so my installation was a recreation of an altarpiece. I consciously chose elements that were everyday objects as a way to not separate art from life and life from art. So I wanted people to look at something and question, is that art? Is that life? And in my perspective, it's both. So I recreated an altar. And in most Chinese homes, there's a family altar somewhere in the home where you have the central portrait of your grandfather or deceased ancestor. And every year, light the candles and you put out food offerings. And so what I did in my piece, I took individual photographs of four different ethnic Asians, myself as a Chinese American, my friend Kanataka Ikeda, who's Japanese, another Japanese American, Bob Shimabukuro, who is a Hawaiian, and Lisa Ko-Reed. She was a Korean adoptee. And so I had these four different ethnic Asians represented. But from these individual portraits, I created a central image. And from each element sliced and interwoven in to create a larger central image. And this is to represent the myth of who we're supposed to look like, hence the title, All Orientals Look Alike. But at the same time, I wanted to convey the power of our energy to break that stereotype. But at the same time, I was surprised and perplexed to see a reviewer. He viewed the image as a violent kind of destructive act, as if someone had taken a knife and made slashes into that central image.
Well, that leads me to wonder what a reviewer thought of All American, because that's a picture of a braid, essentially, a man's braid being chopped by a cleaver, right?
That was a reflection of a combination of things. Just my life growing up in a Chinese kitchen, I have a lot of elements that reflect that environment. So the stainless steel table with a round chopping block, which was an element of a Chinese kitchen and my culture. And it was my hair, my braid, that I had placed on that chopping block with a cleaver embedded in the block to symbolize the loss that individuals have to go through to assimilate. That even though my hair represents something tangible that we lose, or many Chinese men had to cut off their queues because of the racism that existed, and also as a choice to acclimate to American society. And so I wanted to symbolize that, but also the pain and the abruptness of the act of having to lose oneself, one's identity, one's history in that process. And I found a visual way to communicate that concept. And so that's the nature of my work. There's no uniformity in terms of particular subject or medium, but it's the idea that generates the elements that I pull together. And also the fact, as a woman, I'm small, and I want to be able to create objects that are manageable, that I myself can do and pull together without having to call on the assistance of someone else.
Well, in Chinks, that was actually in some ways subtle, because it's essentially this beautiful stack of books with some missing holes in it, right, in the stack. And so what was your comment on that piece?
Chinks was a piece that I had conceptually in my mind for many years. Over that time period, I had different manifestations of it, and the book piece was the third form of visualization I had for that piece. It consisted of a series of encyclopedias, textbooks, and more contemporary books. I wanted to highlight the voids in our education. Growing up, encyclopedias were a staple in many homes in that time period, the 60s, 70s, 80s. People bought encyclopedias, and our father bought, we had three sets of encyclopedias in our home because we didn't have this access to the internet as we do today for our information. But what I did was use these books to create a wall with chinks in it. And behind that wall, I wanted to relay a sense of my own childhood, growing up in grade school, and you're learning about American history and studies, and Asian American history was not a part of that. Native American history was not a part of that. African American history was not a part of that. And so much is missing, you know, in our education and still today. And so I wanted to make that political and social point that, you know, even behind the wall of books, I placed a school desk with the stereotypes that were conveyed in our education, a book on cowboys and Indians, a book about Christopher Columbus. And then above the desk and the books were a map of the world. And on that map was China. But again, it was like a big yellow spot. And you know, there's no real reference to China in our education or acknowledgement of it because it was a communist country and it was a negative, you know.
Well, in many ways, it's still very negative, isn't it? Because especially with all the anti-Asian COVID-related racism and hate crimes, I mean, it's still, your work is still very relevant, Roberta, I have to say.
Thank you.
So yeah, your work is still very relevant. I mean, your themes of identity, ethnicity, ritual, and transformation, especially in light of all that's happening with the anti-Asian racism and hate crimes. You know, I think that you did a lot of relevant work as well at the IFCC because you really brought in a lot of artists and you supported so many people during your 15 years. And you know, a lot of people who've just moved to Portland, let's say in the last 5 to 10 years, don't really think of IFCC much except as a place to rent, you know, as a venue to rent. But when I moved to Portland in 89, I found it to be such a vibrant, multicultural place. And it was so welcoming to me as a playwright, to theater companies of color. But it also produced, you know, a season of plays, of multicultural plays. And you really kept that gallery going. Every month it was a new show, you know, and it really brought together a lot of people. How important did you think IFCC was at the time?
IFCC was my dream job. I had left the family business and I really didn't have a destination or plan. But I recently had discovered that IFCC existed and that it had a multicultural community that it supported. And it was my exhibit at the Chinese Consolidated Benevolent Association that brought me attention from Sue Busby, who was the executive director of IFCC at that time. And she approached me and asked if I'd be interested in working with IFCC as their gallery coordinator. And at this time, IFCC had just recently opened and they had the theater in operation and the gallery was not formally established. They had space on their second floor that functioned as a multi-purpose room. And there were local artists that had exhibited there from the community, people that were members of the Members Gallery, which was an African-American collective of artists, again, under the auspices of Catherine Bogle. The mission was to promote the visibility and the economic opportunity for artists of color as a showcase of different cultures in our community. But I was very focused on allowing artists to self-identify because I did not want to just expect Native artists to do Native art and African-American artists to do African art. You know, it was to kind of break through those stereotypes as well. I was really grateful to work with established artists like Charlotte Lewis and Adrian Cruz, who were foundational in the African American community for sharing not only the richness of their work, but also the richness they had with their African community and heritage. Charlotte and Adrian were the primary organizers of Kwanzaa.
Was IFCC one of the first places to have a regular Kwanzaa celebration?
We were one of a handful. It wasn't so much based in a location back then as it was centered around people. People like Joyce Harris, who were instrumental in bringing community together, Art Alexander, they created Kwanzaa. And it very much was like the way Pica is set up in the way they would find venues to do Kwanzaa in. And also because Kwanzaa had 7 days of celebration, 7 principles. We were usually the venue on the day of creativity, Kujichagulia.
Well, it just sounds like there's so much that you're proud of there at the IFCC. What are you most proud of in your gallery curation work at IFCC? Or even just creating the residency program that you did for artists?
The residency program was one of the special things that I felt proud of for visual artists. Acknowledging artists who were active in their communities, who volunteered and gave of themselves to help others in their community, and also to provide them with the economic resources in an award. We only did this for 4 years, but in the Visual Arts Gallery, we acknowledged the work of Adrian Cruz, Lillian Pitt, Pat Courtney Gold, and Richard Brown. Again, people who were, again, embedded in their communities and able to share in forms that was suitable to them, you know, be it a lecture or a workshop or performance of some sort as a way of fulfilling their commitment to the residency.
You have given a lot of people work. You know, you've given them a place to not only show their work, but also to be known and to be able to make a living. So, because you have done a lot to change the landscape here. Kudos to you. And I hope that, you know, you take that because you're so selfless.
Well, I'm enjoying retirement now, and although it's taken me a while to kind of not feel guilty about not working, but I've given myself time to just kind of lay low and just enjoy a sense of alignment, you know, of my inner life and my outer life. And I'm looking forward to being 80 and when my body allows me to be a better rock hounder and keep looking for those pretty rocks and enjoying the life.
I had no idea. You're looking pretty darn good, I have to say. Roberta Wong, veteran artist, arts advocate, just all around, you know, social justice warrior. So great to have you here and to be able to sit down, you know, in our separate places, but just to talk with you because we've known each other through the years. But this is the longest amount of time that we've spent in conversation. So I thank you for that.
Thank you, Dime. I love you.
Aw, kudos to you for everything that you've done. Thank you for being on Stage and Studio and Arts Watch on this Women's History Month episode. And that's it for this week. You can always catch the show on stageandstudio.org and Arts Watch at orartswatch.org. Also, subscribe to any podcast platform. I'm on there, so do it. Just follow the links on whatever you're listening on. So like us on facebook.com/stageandstudio. That's it. Stage and Studio will be back on Arts Watch in 2 weeks. Till next time, I'm Dime Roberts.